we're reading and we're talking at this moment about the CIA subsidized experiments of a gentleman by the name of Dr. Isbell, I-S-B-E-L-L.
Recall now, he was administering LSD under all kinds of strange conditions to inmates, people who were trying to get themselves cured of drug addiction, as a matter of fact, that it basically what amounted almost to an outpatient treatment center in Lexington, Massachusetts.
Kentucky.
Lexington, Kentucky, rather. These were people that were trying to get off drugs, and so Dr. Isbell, with his CIA-financed research, was doing was administering large quantities of LSD to them. The irony of that, I don't think, needs to be underscored any
further.
And
then paying them off with heroin and morphine for going through the LSD experience. So,
well, just as long as he was fair.
Yeah, a real prince, a real... anyway, we're going to go on. We're going to continue with Acid Dreams, talking about the experiments and we'll let it speak for itself. CIA documents describe experiments conducted by Isbell, this of course Dr. Harris Isbell, Lexington, Kentucky, in which certain patients, nearly all black inmates, were given LSD for more than 75 consecutive days. In order to overcome tolerance to the hallucinogen, Isbell administered, quote, double, triple, and quadruple doses. A report dated May 5, 1959, comments on experiments involving psilocybin, a semi-synthetic version of the magic mushroom. Subjects who ingested the drug became extremely anxious, although sometimes there were periods of intense elation marked by, quote, continuous gales of laughter. A few patients felt that, quote, they had become very large or had shrunk to the size of children. Their hands or feet did not seem to be their own and sometimes took on the appearance of animal paws. They reported many fantasies or dreamlike states in which they seemed to be elsewhere. Fantastic experiences, such as trips to the moon or living in gorgeous castles, were occasionally reported, unquote. Isbell concluded, quote, despite these striking subjective experiences, the patients remained oriented in time, place, and person. In most instances, the patients did not lose their insight, but realized that the effects were due to the drug. Two of the nine patients, however, did lose insight and felt that their experiences were caused by the experimenters controlling their minds, unquote. In addition to his role as a research scientist, Dr. Isbell served as a go-between for the CIA in its attempts to obtain drug samples from European pharmaceutical concerns, which assumed they were providing medicine to a U.S. public health official. The CIA, in turn, acted as a research coordinator, passing information, tips, and leads to Isbell and its other contract employees so that they could keep abreast of each other's progress. When a new discovery was made, the CIA would often ask another researcher to conduct a follow-up study for confirmation. One scientist whose work was coordinated with Isbell's in such a manner was Dr. Carl Pfeiffer, P-F-E-I-F-F-E-R, a noted pharmacologist from Princeton who tested LSD on inmates at the federal prison in Atlanta and the Bordentown Reformatory in New Jersey. Isbell, Pfeiffer, Cameron, West, and Hoke all were part of a network of doctors and scientists who gathered intelligence for the CIA. Through these scholar informants, the agency stayed on top of the latest developments within the, quote, above-ground LSD scene, which expanded rapidly during the Cold War.
Now, as indicated in the first section of the broadcast, the use of LSD by American psychological research organizations and individuals was spurred by this CIA domestic funding. Now, we're going to look at the next major stage of the CIA's LSD testing, in which not only were people tested without being told precisely what was going to be done to them, but people were tested in an outside or street contexts. In other words, no longer was this being done inside of mental and penal institutions. This was being done out on the streets of America, and it's at this point, and we're going to take a look at this street testing, so to speak, again, of unwitting human subjects, this under the CIA's MKUltra program. It was in the course of the MKUltra program that eventually the LSD spread to the society as a whole. Continuing with Acid Dreams. In a speech before the National Alumni Conference at Princeton University on April 10, 1953, newly appointed CIA Director Alan Dulles lectured his audience on, quote, how the sinister battle for men's minds had become in Soviet hands, unquote. The human mind, Dulles warned, was a malleable tool, and the Red Menace had secretly developed brain perversion techniques. Some of these methods were so subtle and so abhorrent to our way of life that we have recoiled from facing up to them. Dulles continued, "The minds of selected individuals who are subjected to such treatment are deprived of the ability to state their own thoughts. Parrot-like, the individuals so conditioned can merely repeat the thoughts which have been implanted in their minds by suggestions from outside. In effect, the brain becomes a phonograph, playing a disc put on its spindle by an outside genius over which it has no control." Unquote. 3 days after delivering this address, Dulles authorized Operation MK-Ultra, the CIA's major drug and mind control program during the Cold War. MK-Ultra was the brainchild of Richard Helms, a high-ranking member of the clandestine services, otherwise known as the Dirty Tricks Department, who championed such methods throughout his career as an intelligence officer. As Helms explained to Dulles when he first proposed the MK-Ultra project, aside from the offensive potential, the development of a comprehensive capability in this field gives us a thorough knowledge of the enemy's theoretical potential, thus enabling us to defend ourselves against a foe who might not be as restrained in the use of these techniques as we are, unquote. The super-secret MK-Ultra program was run by a relatively small unit within the CIA known as the Technical Services Staff, or TSS. Originally established as a supplementary funding mechanism to the Artichoke Project, MK-Ultra quickly grew into a mammoth undertaking that outflanked earlier mind control initiatives.
And those of you who are prone to a black sense of humor will have to probably refrain from some dark chuckles over Alan Dulles talking about the brain perversion techniques and the sinister Soviets while the CIA was jamming ice picks into people's brains to keep them from talking about the experiments that had been done to them. Continuing in acid dreams. Incidents such as this...
Oh, by the way, the authors are talking about human experimentation on subjects.
Yes, this is a CIA operative himself who had a very, very bad experience on LSD. Incidents such as these reaffirmed to the MK-Ultra crew just how devastating a weapon LSD could be. But this only made them more enthusiastic about the drug. They kept springing it on people in a manner reminiscent of the ritual hazing of fraternity pledges. Quote, "It was just too damned informal," a TSS officer later said. "We didn't know much. We were playing around in ignorance. We were just naive about what we were doing." Such pranks claimed their first victim in November 1953, when a group of CIA and Army technicians gathered for a 3-day work retreat at a remote hunting lodge in the backwoods of Maryland. On the second day of the meeting, Dr. Gottlieb spiked the after-dinner cocktails with LSD. As the drug began to take effect, Gottlieb told everyone that they had ingested a mind-altering chemical. By that time, the group had become boisterous with laughter and unable to carry on a coherent conversation. One man was not amused by the unexpected turn of events. Dr. Frank Olson, an Army scientist who specialized in biological warfare research, had never taken LSD before, and he slid into a deep depression. His mood did not lighten when the conference adjourned. Normally a gregarious family man, Olson returned home quiet and withdrawn. When he went to work after the weekend, he asked his boss to fire him because he had, quote, messed up the experiment during the retreat. Alarmed by his erratic behavior, Olson's superiors contacted the CIA, which sent him to New York to see Dr. Harold Abramson. A respected physician, Abramson taught at Columbia University and was chief of the allergy clinic at Mount Sinai Hospital. He was also one of the CIA's principal LSD researchers and a part-time consultant to the Army Chemical Corps. While these were impressive credentials, Abramson was not a trained psychiatrist, and it was this kind of counseling his patient desperately needed. For the next few weeks, Olson confided his deepest fears to Abramson. He claimed the CIA was putting something in his coffee to make him stay awake at night. He said people were plotting against him, and he heard voices at odd hours commanding him to throw away his wallet, which he did, even though it contained several uncashed checks. Dr. Abramson concluded that Olson was mired in, quote, a psychotic state with delusions of persecution that had been, quote, crystallized by the LSD experience. Arrangements were made to move him to Chestnut Lodge, a sanatorium in Rockville, Maryland, staffed by CIA-cleared psychiatrists. Apparently, other CIA personnel who suffered from psychiatric disorders were enrolled in this institution. On his last evening in New York, Olson checked into a room at the Statler Hilton along with a CIA agent assigned to watch him. And then, in the wee hours of the morning, the troubled scientist plunged headlong through a closed window to his death 10 floors below.
Continuing with acid dreams, the Olson suicide had immediate repercussions within the CIA. An elaborate cover-up erased clues to the actual circumstances leading up to his death. Olson's widow was eventually given a government pension, and the full truth of what happened would not be revealed for another 20 years. Meanwhile, CIA Director Alan Dulles suspended the in-house testing program for a brief period while an internal investigation was conducted. In the end, Gottlieb and his team received only a mildly worded reprimand for exercising bad judgment, unquote, but no records of the incident were kept in their personnel files which would harm their future careers. The importance of LSD eclipsed all other considerations, and the secret acid tests resumed. Gottlieb was now ready to undertake the final and most daring phase of the MKUltra program. LSD would be given to unwitting targets in real-life situations. But who would actually do the dirty work? While looking through some old OSS files, Gottlieb discovered that marijuana had been tested on unsuspecting subjects in an effort to develop a truth serum. These experiments had been organized by George Hunter White, a tough, old-fashioned narcotics officer who ran a training school for American spies during World War II. Perhaps White would be interested in testing drugs for the CIA. As a matter of protocol, Gottlieb first approached Harry Anslinger, chief of the Federal Narcotics Bureau. Anslinger was favorably disposed and agreed to lend, unquote, one of his top men to the CIA on a part-time basis. Right from the start, White had plenty of leeway in running his operations. He rented an apartment in New York's Greenwich Village, and with funds supplied by the CIA, he transformed it into a safe house complete with two-way mirrors, surveillance equipment, and the like. Posing as an artist and a seaman, White lured people back to his pad and slipped them drugs. A clue as to how his subjects fared can be found in White's personal diary, which contains passing references to surprise LSD experiments. Quote, Gloria gets horrors, Janet sky high, unquote. The frequency of bad reactions prompted White to coin his own word for the drug, Stormy, which was how he referred to LSD throughout his 14-year stint as a CIA operative. In 1955, White was transferred to San Francisco, where two more safe houses were established. During this period, he initiated Operation Midnight Climax, in which drug-addicted prostitutes were hired to pick men up from local bars and bring them back to a CIA-financed bordello. Unknowing customers were treated to drinks laced with LSD while White sat on a portable toilet behind a two-way mirror, sipping martinis and watching every stoned and kinky moment. As payment for their services, the hookers received $100 a night, plus a guarantee from White that he'd intercede on their behalf should they be arrested while plying their trade. In addition to providing data about LSD, Midnight Climax enabled the CIA to learn about the sexual proclivities of those who passed through the safe houses. White's harem of prostitutes became the focal point of an extensive CIA study of how to exploit the art of lovemaking for espionage purposes. So again, under the MKUltra program, the LSD testing by the CIA moves from penal and mental institutions to street situations. And as we're going to take a look now, as we begin looking at what the authors Lee and Schlein refer to as psychedelic pioneers, in other words, the LSD proselytizers, people who were responsible for the growing cultural popularity of LSD, we're going to find, as we, so to speak, swing the camera away from some of the main figures involved in LSD proselytization, and we're going to find many of the same people involved in the CIA's mind control programs, and specifically in the LSD testing on various human subjects. Well, as I say, when we turn the camera away from these psychedelic proselytizers, we always find the key figures in the CIA's programs just off camera, I guess you could say, just waiting in the wings.
All right, now we're going to talk about, as Dave put, one of these psychedelic pioneers, as Lee and Schlein term him. They also call him the original Captain Trips.
This is, although most people usually associate names like Tim Leary and Ken Kesey, both of whom we're going to talk about, the original LSD proselytizer was a man named Captain Alfred M. Hubbard, and where the Captain moniker comes from, we will find out right now.
The stout, crew-cut figure riding in the Rolls-Royce was a mystery to those who knew him. A spy by profession, he lived a life of intrigue and adventure befitting his chosen career. Born dirt poor in Kentucky, he served with the OSS during the Second World War and went on to make a fortune as a uranium entrepreneur. His prestigious government and business connections read like a who's who of the power elite in North America. His name was Captain Alfred M. Hubbard. His friends called him Cappy, and he was known as the Johnny Appleseed of LSD. The blustery, rum-drinking Hubbard is widely credited with being the first person to emphasize LSD's potential as a visionary or transcendental drug. His faith in the LSD revelation was such that he made it his life's mission to turn on as many men and women as possible. Quote, "Most people are walking in their sleep," he said. "Turn them around, start them in the opposite direction, and they wouldn't even know the difference." But there was a quick way to remedy that. Give them a good dose of LSD and, quote, "let them see themselves for what they are." That Hubbard, of all people, should have emerged as the first genuine LSD apostle is all the more curious in light of his long-standing affiliation with the cloak-and-dagger trade. Indeed, he was no run-of-the-mill spook. As a high-level OSS officer, the captain directed an extremely sensitive covert operation that involved smuggling weapons and war material to Great Britain prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor. In pitch darkness, he sailed ships without lights up the coast to Vancouver, where they were refitted and used as destroyers by the British Navy. He also flew planes to the border, took them apart, towed the pieces into Canada, and sent them to England. These activities began with the quiet approval of President Roosevelt nearly a year and a half before the U.S. officially entered the war. To get around the neutrality snag, Hubbard became a Canadian citizen in a mock procedure. While based in Vancouver, where he later settled, he personally handled several million dollars filtered by the OSS through the American consulate to finance a multitude of covert operations in Europe. All this, of course, was highly illegal, and President Truman later issued a special pardon with kudos to the captain and his men. Not long after receiving this presidential commendation, Hubbard was introduced to LSD by Dr. Ronald Sandison of Great Britain. During his first acid trip in 1951, he claimed to have witnessed his own conception. Quote, "It was the deepest mystical thing I've ever seen," the captain recounted. "I saw myself as a tiny mite in a big swamp with a spark of intelligence. I saw my mother and father having intercourse. It was all clear."
Before we go on to analyze Hubbard's role in becoming the, quote, Johnny Appleseed of LSD, some more information about his background, continuing with acid dreams. After his legendary exploits with the OSS, the captain continued to serve as an undercover operative for various agencies within the U.S. government. He had many contacts with the FBI, for example, and he claimed to be a close friend of J. Edgar Hoover's. "That old bugger was tough, really tough," Hubbard said with admiration, "but when he tried to turn on the FBI chief, Hoover stubbornly declined. However, the captain did manage to give the drug, quote, to some top intelligence men in Washington, always with good results," unquote. During the early 1950s, Hubbard was asked to join the CIA, but he refused. "They lied so much, cheated so much, I don't like them," he snarled. "They're lousy deceivers, sons of the devils themselves," unquote. The captain's beef with the agency stemmed in part from his unsuccessful attempt to secure back pay owed to him from his OSS days. "They crooked me," he complained bitterly. As to whether or not, interrupting here, as to whether or not his denials of working for CIA are to be taken at face value, listen to the following information. Hubbard was unkindly disposed toward the CIA for other reasons as well. Most important, he didn't approve of what the agency was doing with his beloved LSD. "The CIA work stinks," he said. "They were misusing it. I tried to tell them how to use it, but even when they were killing people, you couldn't tell them a goddamn thing." Hubbard was certain that Frank Olson was not the only person who died as a result of the CIA's surprise acid tests. "I don't know how Al's Washington affairs were done," Dr. Osmond admitted. That's Dr. Humphrey Osmond, about whom we're going to read more in a second. He worked very closely with Al Hubbard. Resuming, I don't know how Al's Washington affairs were done," Dr. Osmond admitted. "He was one of those naturally brilliant wheeler dealers. Indeed, Hubbard seemed to have a knack for popping up in the most unpredictable places. He worked for the Treasury Department as a young man during the Capone days, busting moonshiners and gangsters who were smuggling liquor into the U.S. from Canada. Apparently, he was able to ingratiate himself with both sides during Prohibition, as he subsequently became Deputy Chief of Security for the Tropicana Hotel in Las Vegas. Those mafia men were always interesting to talk to," Hubbard remarked, "but they never smiled," unquote. The captain also engaged in undercover work for a number of other government agencies, including the Federal Narcotics Bureau and the Food and Drug Administration, at a time when both organizations were assisting the CIA's drug testing programs. During the mid-1960s, he was employed by Teledyne, a major defense subcontractor, as, quote, "Director of Human Factors Research," unquote. In this capacity, Hubbard served as advisor and consultant to a combined Navy and NASA project that involved testing the effects of psychochemical agents on a newly designed helicopter avionics system, unquote. Teledyne worked closely with various government organizations, including the CIA, to apply these techniques to additional areas of military interest. While Hubbard was not a CIA operative per se, his particular area of expertise, hallucinogenic drugs, brought him into close contact with elements of the espionage community. The CIA must have known what he was up to, since Sandoz and the FDA kept the agency informed whenever anyone received shipments of LSD. The captain, of course, was one of their best customers, having purchased large amounts of the drug on different occasions. So although as they indicated, it cannot be said that Al Hubbard was a CIA operative per se, he was a veteran, lifelong intelligence agent connected intimately with many different agencies of the U.S. National Security Establishment, and as we said, he was the Johnny Appleseed of LSD.
One of the interesting things about Cappy Hubbard, we're going to be reading a little bit more about him in a moment. One of the interesting things about Hubbard is that here is a man who claimed that LSD changed his entire life, that most people are walking through life in a daze, not understanding what's going on, and the thing that they need to do is to take LSD to change their perspective on things. Yet here's a man who took LSD in 1951 and still managed to work for all sorts of various government agencies involved in all kinds of military research and things of that nature. So as far as the common kind of cliche experience of people turning on to LSD and dropping out, it certainly didn't seem to affect Cappy Hubbard that way. He seemed, as a matter of fact, to continue even stronger, working for the government and for the defense establishment and working in various things having to do with human factors research, quote unquote.
Now we're going to take a look at Hubbard's work with a civilian researcher named Dr. Humphrey Osmond, and civilian perhaps should be taken in quotes because he too had strong connections to the CIA's LSD research, although it cannot be said how aware he was of the source of this funding. But the point is, Al Hubbard and Dr. Humphrey Osmond became two of the pioneers of, quote, LSD therapy, unquote, and they in turn turned on a person who was to become one of the major proselytizers of the so-called psychedelic era and one of the people whose literary work spurred a great many people to experiment with LSD and other hallucinogens, Aldous Huxley.
All right. Hubbard, then 49 years old, eagerly sought out others familiar with hallucinogenic drugs. He contacted Dr. Humphrey Osmond, a young British psychiatrist who was working with LSD and mescaline at Weyburn Hospital in Saskatchewan, Canada. Like most other researchers in the field, Osmond was primarily interested in psychosis and mental illness. In 1952, he shocked the medical world by drawing attention to the structural similarity between the mescaline and adrenaline molecules, implying that schizophrenia might be a form of self-intoxication caused by the body mistakenly producing its own hallucinogenic compounds. Osmond noted that mescaline enabled a normal person to see the world through the eyes of a schizophrenic, and he suggested that the drug be used as a tool for training doctors, nurses, and other hospital personnel to understand their patients from a more intimate perspective. Osmond's research attracted widespread attention within scientific circles. The CIA, ever intent on knowing the latest facts as early as possible, quickly sent informants to find out what was happening at Weyburn Hospital. Unbeknownst to Osmond and his cohorts, throughout the next decade, they were contacted on repeated occasions by agency personnel. Indeed, it was impossible for an LSD researcher not to rub shoulders with the espionage establishment, for the CIA was monitoring the entire scene. I'm going to read that again, and then we're going to read a footnote that goes with it. Unbeknownst to Osmond and his cohorts, throughout the next decade, they were contacted on repeated occasions by agency personnel. Indeed, it was impossible for an LSD researcher not to rub shoulders with the espionage establishment, for the CIA was monitoring the entire scene. Now, there's a footnote that goes with this, talking a little bit more about some of Osmond's subsequent involvement. Osmond left Canada in 1963 and joined a group of researchers at the Princeton Neuropsychiatric Institute. There, he worked closely with Dr. Bernard Aronson, whose studies in hypnosis and altered states of consciousness were funded by the CIA through the Society for the Study of Human Ecology. Osmond and Aronson later co-authored a popular anthology called Psychedelics. Unlike Aronson, who was unaware of the CIA's interest in his work, Dr. Carl Pfeiffer, another Princeton researcher, had close ties with the CIA. As one of Pfeiffer's associates put it, quote, Princeton was crawling with agents. They came courting everyone. It was obvious. They would give us whatever we wanted. We realized we were being recruited, but at that time we were flattered that such a prestigious government agency was interested in us, unquote. A little too interested, perhaps, a number of scientists soon discovered that their mail was being opened and read by government agents.
And again, this is worth mentioning because Dr. Humphrey Osmond, along with Al Hubbard, the man he was working with here, became one of the people to strongly influence Aldous Huxley's turn in the direction of pro-psychedelic crusading.
All right, continuing back to the main body of the passage. Osmond's reports also caught the eye of Aldous Huxley, the eminent British novelist who for years had been preoccupied with the specter of drug-induced thought control. In 1931, Huxley wrote Brave New World, a futuristic vision of a totalitarian society in which the world controllers chemically coerced the population into loving its servitude. While Huxley grappled with the question of human freedom under pharmacological attack, he also recognized that certain drugs, particularly the hallucinogens, produced radical changes in consciousness that could have a profound and beneficial effect. Upon learning of Osmond's work, he decided to offer himself as a guinea pig. Huxley seemed like the perfect subject. A learned man steeped in many disciplines, he was also gifted with a writer's eloquence. Even if the drug confounded him, it would not tongue-tie him, for he was a glorious talker. But Osmond was still a bit apprehensive. Quote, I did not relish the possibility, however remote, of being the man who drove Aldous Huxley mad, he explained. His worries proved to be unfounded. In May 1953, less than a month after the CIA initiated Operation MKUltra, Huxley tried mescaline for the first time at his home in Hollywood Hills, California, under Osmond's supervision. Quote, it was, according to Huxley, without question the most extraordinary and significant experience this side of the beatific vision. Moreover, quote, it opens up a host of philosophical problems, throws intense light, and raises all manner of questions in the field of aesthetics, religion, theory of knowledge. Huxley described his mescaline adventure in the famous essay The Doors of Perception, which took its title from the works of William Blake, the 18th century British poet and visionary artist. With this book, Huxley unabashedly declared himself a propagandist for hallucinogenic drugs. And for the first time, a large segment of the educated public became aware of the existence of these substances. Not surprisingly, the treatise created a storm in literary circles. Some hailed it as a major intellectual statement, others dismissed it as pure quackery. Few critics realized that the book would have such an enormous impact in years to come.
So again, Aldous Huxley, whose book, the aforementioned Doors of Perception, was one of the pivotal motivators, I guess you could say, in terms of inclining people towards recreational hallucinogen use in the 60s, it should be noted that his introduction to psychedelic drugs came via Dr. Humphrey Osmond, who worked with Dr. Bernard Aronson on some of the CIA's LSD projects. And in turn, Humphrey Osmond and Al Hubbard, the people who, quote, turned on, so to speak, Aldous Huxley, are two of the people, well, basically, Dr. Humphrey Osmond is heavily involved with Al Hubbard, who himself is an intelligence agent. And again, the point we're making here is that as we begin examining the cultural figures who were most responsible for the introduction of LSD into society as a recreational drug, when we move the camera off them, we find the CIA's LSD researchers and other intelligence people waiting in the wings. Of Aldous Huxley, the author of The Doors of Perception and some of his other intelligence connections, we will examine a couple of interesting footnotes here in Acid Dreams. Of Huxley, the authors Schlein and Lee write, in his letters, Huxley mentioned, my friend Dr. J. West, a reference to Jolly West, who conducted LSD studies for the CIA. At one point, while West was engaged in MKUltra research, Huxley suggested that he hypnotize his subjects prior to administering LSD in order to give them, quote, post-hypnotic suggestions aimed at orienting the drug-induced experience in some desired direction, unquote. Needless to say, the CIA was intrigued with this idea. Huxley also lectured on parapsychology at Duke University, where J.B. Rhine, R-H-I-N-E, with whom Huxley communicated, was engaged in ESP studies for the CIA and the Army. Well, Dr. Louis Joylon West, J-O-Y-L-O-N, was a person who we touched on briefly in the previous description of the CIA's early LSD research. He was the fellow who administered 300,000 micrograms to an elephant to see if he could simulate the rut madness, and then the elephant simply keeled over. Well, Louis Jolyon West, friend of Aldous Huxley, key CIA LSD researcher, is an interesting fellow. In another footnote, Lee and Schlein write, West was head of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Oklahoma during the 1950s and early 1960s, when he conducted research into LSD, hypnosis, and, quote, the psychobiology of dissociated states, unquote, for the CIA. It was West who administered a massive dose of LSD to an elephant as part of an ill-fated drug experiment. In 1964, he was called upon to examine Jack Ruby, who had murdered Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of President Kennedy. After visiting Ruby in his jail cell, West concluded that he had sunk into a, quote, paranoid state manifested by delusions, visual and auditory hallucinations, and suicidal impulses, unquote. Ruby was not faking these symptoms, West asserted, since he had vigorously rejected the doctor's repeated suggestions that he was mentally ill. Quote, the true malingerer usually grasps eagerly at such an explanation, said West. Since Ruby would not admit he was crazy, West concluded he was nuts. Catch 22. Ruby's delusions, unquote, included the belief that an ultra-right-wing conspiracy was behind the death of the president. On the basis of Dr. West's diagnosis, Ruby became a candidate for treatment of mental disorders. Another doctor soon put him on happy pills, unquote, although these drugs did not seem to cheer Ruby up. 2 years later, he died of cancer while still in prison. West, meanwhile, moved to Los Angeles, where he served as director of UCLA's Neuropsychiatric Institute, a position he still holds. In the early 1970s, he became embroiled in a heated controversy over plans for a Center for the Study and Reduction of Violence. Originally proposed by Governor Ronald Reagan, the Violence Center would have exceeded even Jack Ruby's worst paranoid nightmares had it not been scuttled by the California state legislature after information about it was leaked to the press. West, who helped formulate plans for the center, described the program as an attempt, quote, to predict the probability of occurrences, unquote, of violent behavior among specific population groups. The major known correlates of violence, according to West, are sex, male, age, youthful, ethnicity, black, and urbanicity, unquote. The Violence Center was to have been housed in a former military base located in a remote area of California. The medical facility at Vacaville Prison, the site of a major CIA drug testing program during the late 1960s and early 1970s, was listed among the facilities that would have been used to develop treatment models and implement pilot and demonstration programs for the Violence Center. Treatments discussed by West included chemical castration, psychosurgery, and the testing of experimental drugs on involuntarily incarcerated individuals. Furthermore, the activities of the center were to have been coordinated with a California law enforcement program that maintained computer files on pre-delinquent children so that they could be treated before they made a negative mark on society. Well, we've talked about a number of those different things in other archive shows. We talked about the UCLA study Center for the Study and Reduction of Violence in Radio Free America number 5, the first of our three-part series about mind control. We talked about Jack Ruby at great length in several of our Guns of November programs and others. Of course, his delusion that an ultra-right-wing conspiracy was behind the assassination of President Kennedy was about as delusional as the notion that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. And it should be noted that at one point it was believed axiomatic that the sun revolved around the earth. The notion that Lee Harvey Oswald is a lone nut will hold about as much water as the geocentric theory of the geocentric theory of the solar system. The point is that Louis Jolyon West, a confidant, a colleague, and personal friend of Aldous Huxley, who in turn was turned on to LSD by Humphrey Osmond and Al Hubbard, Hubbard a lifelong intelligence agent, Humphrey Osmond one of the CIA's LSD researchers. It's worth noting the connections of Aldous Huxley, and this is not to indict the man in terms of an overall human being, but his LSD, his psychedelic proselytization, and his experiences with the drug are, again, inseparable from the intelligence community.
Continuing with another section of Acid Dreams, they're talking here about, of course, Allen Ginsberg, the poet, but they're talking specifically about the experience they talk about is a bad trip that Allen Ginsberg had. The trip itself, not so significant to it as how it came to be that Allen Ginsberg took the LSD in the first place. This became apparent to poet Allen Ginsberg when he took LSD for the first time at the Mental Research Institute in Palo Alto, California in 1959. Ginsberg was already familiar with psychedelic substances, having experimented with peyote on a number of occasions. As yet, however, there was no underground supply of LSD, and it was virtually impossible for lay folk to procure samples of the drug. Thus, he was pleased when Gregory Bateson, the anthropologist, put him in touch with a team of doctors in Palo Alto. Ginsberg had no way of knowing that one of the researchers associated with the Institute, Dr. Charles Savage, had conducted hallucinogenic drug experiments for the U.S. Navy in the early 1950s. And we're going to read the footnote on Gregory Bateson. Formerly a member, remember this is the, quote, anthropologist, formerly a member of the Research and Analysis Branch of the OSS, Bateson was the husband and co-worker of anthropologist Margaret Mead. An exceptional intellect, he was turned on to acid by Dr. Harold Abramson, one of the CIA's chief LSD specialists. And Dr. Harold Abramson, of course, you heard that name already tonight because he was the man who was, quote, treating Frank Olson at the time that Frank Olson jumped out of a 10th-floor hotel window.
Right. So, again, with regard to Allen Ginsberg, and he was another of the major LSD proselytizers during the 1960s and 70s, again, his introduction to the drug, again, is inseparable from the intelligence community and the CIA's use of LSD on unwitting civilian subjects, and obviously some witting civilian subjects as well. Palo Alto, where Allen Ginsberg was introduced to LSD via people whose introduction came from the CIA, was also the place where Ken Kesey, another famous LSD proselytizer, was introduced to the drug. And he, too, was introduced to the drug via the U.S. National Security Establishment. Kesey's introduction to LSD is described by the authors as follows. Nearly a decade before, Kesey was introduced to psychedelics as part of a government-funded drug study in Palo Alto. Nearly a decade before Kesey was introduced to psychedelics as part of a government-funded drug study in Palo Alto, the CIA embarked upon a major effort to develop LSD into an effective mind-control weapon. The CIA's behavior modification programs were geared toward domestic as well as foreign populations. Targets included selected individuals and large groups of people. So again, the VA hospital through which Ken Kesey was introduced to LSD was as a result of a government-funded study, and the Defense Department, as elsewhere described by these authors, was central to that.
Okay, now they're talking, Lee and Schlein are now talking about a man whose name is very familiar to all of us, that of Timothy Leary. And Timothy Leary, they're talking about, first had his introduction or first heard about or was intrigued by the prospects of LSD by an article by a man by the name of R. Gordon Wasson, who was a vice president of J.P. Morgan and Company. A lifelong, interest in mushrooms led him to try psilocybin, to try the mushrooms themselves. Psilocybin is the synthetic version of same, and to write about his experiences. In Life magazine, among those whose interest was piqued by Wasson's article in Life was a young professor named Timothy Leary. At the time of Wasson's groundbreaking explorations, Leary was pursuing a successful career as a clinical psychologist. Between 1954 and 1959, he was director of clinical research and psychology at the Kaiser Foundation Hospital in Oakland, California. He published extensively in scientific journals and established himself as a rising star in the field of behavioral psychology. He wrote a widely acclaimed psychology textbook and devised a personality test called the Leary, which was used by the CIA, among other organizations, to test prospective employees.
More about Timothy Leary's research at Harvard with initially psilocybin and eventually LSD. Leary returned to Harvard and established a psilocybin research project with the approval of Dr. Harry Murray, chairman of the Department of Social Relations. Dr. Murray, who ran the personality assessment section of the OSS during World War II, took a keen interest in Leary's work. He volunteered for a psilocybin session, becoming one of the first of many faculty and graduate students to sample the mushroom pill under Leary's guidance. Leary had obtained a supply from Sandoz, which distributed the new drug to researchers free of charge. So it's interesting that the departmental chairman under whom Tim Leary initially began his research into hallucinogenic compounds was himself a key OSS veteran, because many of the veterans of the OSS, even after its dissolution, continued to maintain contact with the old boy intelligence networks. Although not formally agents, they continued to associate with and occasionally work with members of the intelligence community. Exactly how the exact nature of the relationship between Dr. Harry Murray and Tim Leary is something that I think future research needs to shed light on.
Now, they're going on to talk about the early days of Leary's LSD experience, which were at when he was at Harvard and were mostly in conjunction with two other educators there, Richard Alpert and Ralph Metzner, two of his associates. And there was a great deal of experimentation going on, a great deal of proselytization of the benefits of LSD as a sort of a purgative of the mind to get everybody out of their tired old ways of thinking. Not everyone was enchanted by the renegade psychedelic scene at Harvard. A confidential memorandum issued by the CIA's Office of Security, which had utilized LSD for interrogation purposes since the early 1950s, suggested that certain CIA-connected personnel might be involved with Leary's group. This prospect was disconcerting to security officials, who considered hallucinogenic drugs, quote, extremely dangerous. Quote, uncontrolled experimentation has in the past resulted in tragic circumstances, and for this reason every effort is made to control any involvement with these drugs, unquote, a CIA agent reported. The document concluded with a specific directive. Quote, information concerning the use of this type of drug for experimental or personal reasons should be reported immediately. In addition, any information of agency personnel involved with Drs. Alpert or Leary, or with any other group engaged in this type of activity, should also be reported, unquote. It is known that during this period, Leary gave LSD to Mary Pinchot, P-I-N-C-H-O-T, a painter and a prominent Washington socialite who was married to Cord Meyer, a high-level CIA official. Meyer oversaw the CIA's infiltration of the U.S. National Student Association and the Congress for Cultural Freedom in Europe, which provided financial support to numerous Cold War liberal intellectuals and writers. Leary and Pinchot struck up a cordial friendship during her occasional visits to Cambridge in the early 1960s. She asked him to teach her how to guide an LSD session so she could introduce the drug to her circles in Washington. Quote, I have this friend who's a very important man, she confided to Leary. He's very impressed with what I've told him about my own LSD experience and what other people have told him. He wants to try it himself. Leary was intrigued, but Pinchot wouldn't tell him who she intended to turn on. Nor did she inform her LSD mentor of her marriage to a CIA bigwig. Leary explained the basic rules about set and setting, emphasizing the importance of a comfortable, sensuous environment for an LSD trip. From time to time, Pinchot reported back to him. I can't give you all the details, she said, but top people in Washington are turning on. You'd be amazed at the sophistication of some of our leaders. We're getting a little group together. Leary had no way of knowing that Mary Pinchot was one of President Kennedy's girlfriends and that she and JFK smoked pot together in the White House. Pinchot was murdered less than a year after Kennedy was assassinated and her diary disappeared from her home. When Leary learned of Pinchot's death, he recalled their conversations about LSD. At various times, she had hinted that the CIA was monitoring his activities. Since drug research is of vital importance to American intelligence, Pinchot told him that he'd be allowed to conduct his experiments as long as it didn't get out of hand. But Leary ignored her advice. In the spring of 1962, he published an article in the Journal of Atomic Scientists, warning that Russians might try to subvert the United States by dumping a few pounds of LSD into the water supply of major cities.
Well, of course, we've seen that that notion was discounted sometime before with the research that was conducted where it was discovered that chlorine neutralized it, although the CIA at least developed another form of LSD that was not chlorine neutralizable, so to speak. The point here is that not only were there reports from the CIA themselves that apparently, quote, CIA-connected personnel might be involved with Leary's group, but as we've noticed, the wife of CIA official Cord Meyer, Mary Pinchot, or Pinchot Meyer, was involved with Tim Leary in terms of LSD experimentation. She also was involved with President Kennedy in terms of romantic dalliance. The point being here that Cord Meyer was a key CIA official. We talked about Cord Meyer, his interrelationship with the Washington Post crowd, and the death and probable assassination of Mary Pinchot in an archive show entitled Gloria in Excelsis, which details the interrelationship between the CIA, the women's movement, and the news media. And it's worth noting that the diary of Mary Pinchot disappeared after her murder. What's not mentioned here, but what is discussed in the archive show Gloria in Excelsis, is that it was CIA counterintelligence official and Knight of Malta James Angleton who destroyed it. And the possible connection between President Kennedy's assassination and the probable assassination of Mary Meyer. She was shot in such a way as strongly suggests that the robbery to which her killing was ascribed would probably, well, it was not that the case. She was shot once in the body and two times in the head. That's not the usual way that a robbery, someone shot during a robbery is eliminated. At any rate, the interrelationship between Leary, Mary Pinchot, Cord Meyer, the CIA, President Kennedy, Kennedy's assassination, and the probable assassination of Mary Meyer, political assassination, that is something worth speculating about.
All right, and at this point, we are going to take another break and give those of you out there taping a chance to turn it over. You are, of course, listening to Radio Free America number 28, and Dave Emery and myself, Nip Tuck, we will return in just a few minutes with more right here on KFJC.